Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, right here on The Mark Steiner Show, on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Before we jump into our conversation, I just want to wish a very happy and thank you Veterans Day to all of our veterans on this Veterans Day, to all my brothers and friends that lost in Vietnam, to my dear friends who served, to my father and those who passed, all our parents who passed, who served, the people serving now, and who came back. I just want to say thank you and happy Veterans Day, and enjoy this day, especially if you work in the federal government, state government, city government, you're off. So really enjoy your Veterans Day. And thank you for not making the traffic so heavy this morning. So we're back to our conversation here. We are going to jump into our conversation about the Republican debate last night, and we're going to begin with a one-on-one conversation with Charles Ellison, a political strategist and a host of the Ellison Report here on WEAA, a new show on WEAA every Sunday evening at 9, and look forward to Charles being a constant here on the Steiner Show as well. And Charles, welcome. Good to have you on the program.
Hey, Mark. Good to be here. Thanks for having me, man.
Always, always, always. So your analysis, I mean, I'll throw this out as I will through our panel in a few minutes. I thought it was the most substantive of the first three of the debates the Republicans have had so far.
No, I can agree with you on that assessment. It was definitely the most substantive of the Republican debates, because we had been talking for quite some time about how substantive, how wonk heavy the first Democratic debate was, and that, you know, to the chagrin of a lot of Republicans, and that's why you suddenly had this, you know, small sort of mutiny of Republican campaigns against the Fourth Estate, against media, in the wake of the CNBC debate, because they felt that they were being treated unfairly. They felt that CNBC was sort of getting into, you know, more of the sort of gossipy fray of the Republican primary campaign, and not into the policy issues, the issues that they want to talk about. And so this particular debate on Fox Business News Channel, sort of succeeded in doing that. I mean, if you want to compare and contrast the Republican debates against that first Democratic debate, and I don't know whose idea it was to have only six Democratic debates, I think that this debate last night probably achieved that. You know, we got some forthrightness from the candidates on how they felt about some fairly key and crucial issues.
Now, I think that this, you know, just as a quick aside here, I think the Democrats are doing themselves a great disservice by having fewer debates. Mm-hmm. The more Republicans are out there debating, the more the country sees them.
Right.
I think it hurts Democrats. I don't know what degree, but I think it's not a very smart strategic move on their part.
It's not. It's very bizarre that that's happened. There are a number of explanations for it, you know, some of them being more political than anything. And you're absolutely right. It's really allowing the Republican brand to suck up all the oxygen in the media room. And so, you know, you're getting the public being more exposed to Republican ideas or conservative ideas about these key policy topics than Democratic ideas. So it seems very imbalanced. And so Republicans understand that they're masters at media spin and media control and manipulation. I mean, look at how the campaigns all came together and manipulated media conglomerates to hold this, you know, to pressured a channel like Fox Business, Fox News Business, and also the Wall Street Journal to ask them the questions they wanted to be asked. I mean, which I find very, one, fascinating, and I find it outrageous as well. But, you know, that all said, for better or for worse, we finally got a substantive debate where it was just the various candidates essentially going after one another on various policy minutiae. And that's really what this whole presidential campaign should be about. It shouldn't be about a name someone called another candidate the other day while on the campaign stuff. That's just ridiculous. We need to hear about what their policy positions were. And Mark, frankly, some rather eye-opening positions last night.
What struck you?
Some of these candidates.
What struck you?
What struck me and what's also striking me the day after that no one is really talking about is how Ben Carson essentially blamed the black unemployment and underemployment on increased wages, and then sort of proposed a sharecropping model, you know, to essentially react to respond to the black unemployment, underemployment crisis. That took me for a loop. I'm like, wow, this cat is actually proposing that we go back to the old sharecrop, the old post-Civil War Reconstruction Jim Crow era sharecropping models. And actually pushing that, and no one has called him. I'm watching for that, reading for it, the morning after, and no one's talking about that. I found that rather eye opening.
Well, one of the things that struck me about that, though, also is that, I mean, all the Republican candidates, and this will be a battleground between Democrats and Republicans, said that we should not raise the minimum wage. I mean that, and the right. argument, you know, as I was looking at some of the fact checking stuff. Economists are pretty, I mean, are really divided on this issue about whether or not raising the minimum wage will help or hinder employment in America.
Right.
And so, I mean, they clearly it's going to be, I mean, they've all kind of, maybe it was overlooked in a sense because two things. A, there's a sensitivity of what Ben Carson said with anybody who deals with race and poverty in America, and that was glaring when he said it. Mm-hmm. But that might have been kind of overshadowed by the fact that every candidate on that platform was basically saying the same thing.
Exactly. You know, everybody was opposed to the minimum wage. And look, the minimum wage is common sense, or raising the minimum wage is common sense, because it's a consumer-based economy. It's an economy based on us buying things. So if you're only making $8 an hour, you can't contribute to the overall national economic cycle. You can't contribute to the 75% of the American economy that's based on the flow of consumer goods. So you're basically proposing it, and that's, you know, conservatives are saying, well, you know, we're looking out for business. What is this about for you? Is it about, you know, economic sort of efficiency, or is it about economic growth? And so, and it's just not, it's not even a liberal or a conservative argument. It's just being practical about the situation. The more money people have in their pockets is the more money they can spend, the more money that they're in that flows into the economy. And that's something that Fox, it was like we agree, it was definitely a wonkish debate, but, obviously, Neil Cavuto and company, they're really not, and Maria Bartiromo, they're not even challenging at all the candidates on the stage, and that's obvious. We understand, you know, based on the relationship between the Republican Party and Fox News. So, but they're not really challenging them on those finer details and maybe, you know, asking about those nuances and saying, you know, hey, don't we need more money in our pockets because, you know, that essentially generates more activity in the economy, especially when they're all acknowledging that we still have a problem with employment. Even though those official unemployment numbers are coming out each month and it shows the unemployment rate decreasing, I will give Fox News credit for pointing out that labor participation rates are low. So everybody acknowledges that you know what, there are still some deep rooted systemic challenges within the economy now a lot of folks are still not feeling this recovery everyone is talking about.
No, and I think that will be another key issue in the campaign coming up, but as it has been a key issue in campaigns for the last 15 years,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think it once again will be, and I think when we get you on the air here live, maybe next week in studio, I know your days are Tuesdays in studios, we'll get you in here. That would be an interesting thing to kind of focus on with where they are with this. I'm not sure that any candidates, Republican nor Democrat, really have the answers to that issue.
Or they have the answers, but they really don't want to go there, right?
I think that's probably what you said. Yes.
You know, they really don't want to go there. I mean, you know, from labor participation rates to, you know, one other thing too, Mark, is that these debates have not focused at all on the K-12 education crisis. So how can you have a skilled labor force? How can you generate activity in the economy? How can you push it forward if your workforce is doesn't have the necessary skill sets it needs to participate? So that starts with K-12 education. We've got a crisis. The White House just 3 weeks ago talked about chronic absenteeism as a major problem within the public school system. We just saw a girl a few weeks ago being body slammed by a school resource officer. That's indicative of a larger problem with American education. I mean, that's not just about police violence. It's also about a larger problem with education, and also the large segments of the population that are being left behind because of that crisis. No one's talking about that on either the Democratic or the Republican side. In fact, they tend to talk about college or higher education more so than K through 12.
Charles Ellison has been our guest in the first part of the program. He's a political strategist, and check him out Sunday nights here at WEAA at 9 p.m. And I'm sure he'll be talking about this and more when he gets in the air Sunday night. Charles, great to have you on. Looking forward to having you in studio soon.
Hey, Mark, it's been a pleasure. I'm looking forward to it as well.
Take care. Thank you so much for your thoughts and analysis. Right. We can take a very brief break and come back with Brian Griffiths, Stella Rouse, and E.R. Shipp as we continue to look at last night's Republican debate. Welcome back. So we're going to continue our conversation about last night's Republican debate. Joining us in studio for the first time in a while, good to have you back, is Brian Griffiths, who is co-founder and editor-in-chief of Red Maryland. Brian, good to see you back.
Great to be back, Mark.
E.R. Shipp is in the studio. Shipp, of course, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist in residence and associate professor of journalism here at Morgan State University School of Global Journalism. Good to see you, Shipp. Welcome.
Howdy.
And joining us by on Skype is Stella Rouse, associate professor in the Department of Government and Politics at the University of Maryland College Park and director of the Center for American Politics and Citizenship. Stella, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. We were tweeting together like crazy last night during the debate, so I'd like to join us by tweet or by phone, 410-319-8888. But one of the things I said, Stella, to Charles Ellison a moment ago was that this, I think, was probably the most substantive debate. I'm curious as your analysis of what you heard that way.
Yeah, I agree. It was very substantive. It dealt with a lot of issues. I'm not sure about the specificity sometimes of the responses. I think there were some responses that weren't even answered, that the answers were not focused on the question that was asked. And then a lot of other questions that a lot of specifics weren't given about broad statements on how to address certain issues. So I agree that the overall context of the debate was much more substantive, directed at important issues, important economic issues. But I would say that the responses that were given were in line with what we've seen in other debates.
Brian Griffiths.
That was the best debate I've seen in a long time, whether Democrat, Republican, general election, primary election. It was so refreshing after the CNBC debate, which I think can be generously described as a dumpster fire. It was really refreshing to see substantive questions, not on gossipy kind of stuff, you know, not the gotcha questions that we saw at the CNBC debate, and that the Fox News moderators actually really did try the best they could to press the candidates for answers. They didn't always get them, you know, as we just mentioned, but I thought it was a really, really quality debate, and as a Republican, I was very pleased to see what we got last night.
Shipp?
Well, they definitely did address substantive issues, or at least substantive issues were raised. I don't know to what extent they were addressed. I wasn't that thrilled with it being the most exciting debate ever, but it did not sink to the level of the CNBC debate, which left the candidates with the opportunity to claim that the press are the enemy, and therefore they don't need to answer substantive questions because the press is the enemy.
And I was glad to see some of the things coming out last night. It was interesting to see people kind of just on a political strategic sense coming out more. I mean, you saw Kasich, Governor Kasich, clearly made a decision he was going to come out and have his voice.
He really needed a hug last night.
He needed a hug. He really needed to tone down a little bit. I think he was a hyperactive kid who was awfully rude at times, too.
I saw some of the tweets that Frank Luntz, the pollster, was doing in focus groups last night, and he said some of the lowest ratings he's ever seen on their dial method was when Kasich was kept interrupting. I mean, it was certainly not something that played well with the electorate, that's for sure.
Well, speaking of the electorate, one of the things that interests me in all this is that we still see Dr. Ben Carson and Donald Trump front and center in these debates, even where they're positioned in the debates physically. I don't think they played as dominant a feature last night as they had in previous debates. But what about the substance of what you all heard from them vis-a-vis the other candidates? Brian, then we'll go to Stella.
Well, you know, first off, Trump and Carson are not substantive candidates. I think that's something that's very clear. You'll notice that once the substance, you know, started, the substantive questions really started to come out, they were very quietly receding into the background. The reason why Trump and Carson are getting so much attention is that, you know, you're getting a lot of the outsider influences in the Republican Party who would rather burn the Republican Party down, quite frankly, than nominate an actual conservative candidate. You know, based on some of the things that we've written at RedMaryland.com, we point out that Trump and Carson are not conservative candidates. They're liberal populist candidates based on some of the issue stances they have taken. They're much more comfortable and be much more comfortable in the Democratic Party than the Republican Party, especially if you look at Trump's history of being pro-universal health care, pro-gun control, higher taxes. You know, all of these things are Democratic issues, and he just happens to be capitalizing upon a populist wave in the Republican Party. As I told you off air, Mark, and I think it's good to bring up now, we see that Carson and Trump are at the top of the polls, and none of the polls that we've seen that keep them at the top of the polls are of likely voters. They're of registered Republican voters. So somebody who has never voted in a primary election in their lives is just as likely to have been polled in these polls of registered voters as somebody who votes in every primary election for the last 20 years. These guys are not substantive candidates. I think that's very clear so far in four debates, and when you hear them on the stump. And as we get closer to the actual voting, when we have the Iowa caucus and we have the New Hampshire primary, and the more debates that we have, I think they're going to continue to be exposed for what they are, which are just non-substantive populist candidates.
Stella?
I agree with all that, but they do have a quarter of the people being polled in the Republican Party of likely voters supporting them. So that's not something to be completely discounted. I do agree that when we get closer to the primary elections that I think they will find it difficult to get broader support. I think at the moment they are capitalizing on a populist or, other sentiments that are out there, frustration with the establishment, things like that really resonate with people that have nothing to do with substance. It's not about the, what specifics they have on particular issues, having to do with the economy, having to do with immigration, having to do with national security. That's not what people are interested in at the moment. But I think moving forward, there will be a push and a demand for more substance and more specificity from these candidates, especially once the field starts dwindling down a little bit. I think that demand will be there, and I think they'll have to step up if they're gonna not fade into the background and give the baton to more established candidates, which I think ultimately is what's going to happen.
Well, Carson was interesting because he seemed to become more quiet and more sleepy as the evening went on,
yeah,
if that's even possible. But he did make some attempts to sound as if he knew what he was talking about when he spoke about, I guess, minimum wage, though he was kind of wonky on that one, and a couple of other issues. But it was clear that he could not hold his own with them when it got into some of the more complicated issues of the Pacific Trade Treaty and those kinds of things. Trump reminded me of a strategy that I used in a graduate school class that I had once when I knew I did not know the material when it got really deep into the policy aspects of international diplomacy. But I realized that if I asked the first question and threw some wit in, it would sound as if I knew what was going on. And that was kind of what Trump was doing last night. You know, he couldn't really hold his own either when it got to the technical aspects, but he could throw in a zinger here and there and sort of at least have his voice in the mix.
And that plays well with his base, too. His base in the Republican Party, you know, is not interested in policy specifics. They're not interested in governing. They're not interested in doing anything but sticking it to the, quote, Republican establishment, unquote, whatever that means to that particular voter. When you actually explain to these alleged conservatives who are supporting Trump, hey, this is what Trump is actually for. This is what Trump has done in the past. This is what Trump's record is. They just brush it off. You know, these are the base that Trump has in the Republican electorate, however large it may be, is not interested in actually implementing conservative ideas. They're not implemented in not interested in implementing Republican ideas, and they're certainly not interested in governing.
So let me play this clip. I think there's certain things here that are dividing Republicans from Democrats, and they actually divided each other last night inside this debate. And one of the issues in this country we're debating is immigration, in this election. Let me play this short clip here between Governor Kasich and Donald Trump, just on immigration, so we can tackle this for a moment.
But if people think that we are going to ship 11 million people who are law-abiding, who are in this country, and somehow pick them up at their house and ship them out of Mexico to Mexico, think about the families. Think about the children. Come on, folks. We all know you can't pick them up and ship them across back across the border. It's a silly argument. It's not an adult argument. It makes no sense.
All I can say, you're lucky in Ohio that you struck oil. That's for one thing. Let me just tell you that Dwight Eisenhower, good president, great president, people liked him. I like Ike, right? The expression, I like Ike, moved 1.5 million illegal immigrants out of this country, moved them just beyond the border, they came back. Moved them again beyond the border, they came back. Didn't like it, moved them way south, they never came back.
Gary, Gerald, it was just a tap.
What happened to my question?
You're not going to have my back. I'm going to have my back.
Now, just very quickly, let me turn to Stella Rouse very quickly first before we go to break in. We'll continue this when we come back. Let you jump in on this is one of your areas as well. I just will throw out here that, A, I thought that this really showed kind of the shallowness of Trump, not because of his position, but because of the way he articulated his position. Mm-hmm. And B, that what he's talking about Eisenhower, do you all remember what that was called?
Yes, Operation Wetback.
Exactly. Thank you.
But you did not hear him say that
right.
in that debate, did
right.
we?
No, that's the name of that program that Eisenhower had. But Stella, your analysis first.
Well, again, first of all, there's absolutely no specificity to what he wants to do. He wants to deport 12 million undocumented immigrants out of the country. But never once have I heard exactly how he wants to go about doing that and how he's going to pay for that. And when anybody calls him on that, on the impracticality of being able to do that, he attacks him, right? He deflects and attacks the person, challenging him on that. The other point about that is that it's very interesting that he refers back to that operation, given the humanitarian, criticism that received, not only at the time, but since that time, anybody that has looked at it historically, and what that did. He's doubling down, tripling down on the rhetoric about illegal immigration, undocumented immigrants, because it's something that has resonated from the very beginning of his campaign. But again, there is no, there are no details about how that's going to happen. And when he actually talks about something, he talks about a very controversial program that had many issues having to do with humanitarian factors. And the fact that the number 1.5 million, that is a number that the Eisenhower administration put forward that has never been shown to be the case. Many people dispute the fact that many undocumented or migrant workers at the time, which is what they were, actually were deported. Numbers have been kicked around more in the 100,000, 200,000 range. So that's not even getting close. Even if we buy the 1.5 million, that's not even close to 11, 12 million people that we're talking about now.
That sort of sounds like something that Trump picked up from Twitter and just retweeted kind of and just sort of articulated it in his speech. He probably doesn't have much more information about that program than just those numbers and that it happened during Eisenhower's days.
Well, he actually mentioned it in a 60-minute interview about 1.5 months ago, and it didn't pick up any kind of steam like it has after this debate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if no one saw the 60-minute interview or if it was kind of brushed aside, but it's something that he's been talking about. He didn't just come up with it for last night's debate. It's something that has been part of his campaign. Not to say that he has any more details about it or knows the details about it, but it is part of his mantra and his rhetoric having to do with undocumented immigrants.
Before we go to break, Brian.
Well, first off, Trump should probably start with some of the properties that he owns where he's had illegal workers working on his property. So he should probably start there. But Trump's plan, if you can call it that, is so nonsensical, and it would take to be blunt, a police state to enforce. It's just dishonest. It's not anything that's going to ever happen. Governor Kasich, I'm not the biggest Governor Kasich fan in the world, but he was absolutely right. Unless you are willing to commit to a police state, which no Republican that I know who's a serious person believes in that, you're not going to deport 12 million people or whatever the number is. Do we need to have immigration reform and a discussion about immigration reform? Absolutely. Trump's not having a discussion. He's just throwing stuff at a wall and hoping it sticks.
Join us here, 410-319-8888. When you hear what you thought about last night's Republican debate, we have some really good folks here today. Here are Charles Ellison at the top of the hour, Brian Griffiths, Stella Rouse, E.R. Shipp, and you at 410-319-8888. You can also send an email to talktosteinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. Here we are as we look at the Republican debate. 410-319-8888. Please join us here with your thoughts and tweet us at Mark Steiner. Or send us an email to talk@steinershow.org as we talk with Stella Rouse, Associate Professor in the Department of Government and Politics at the University of Maryland, where she is Director of the Center for American Politics and Citizenship. E.R. Shipp is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, journalist in residence, and associate professor of journalism at the Morgan State University School of Global Journalism. Brian Griffiths is co-founder and editor-in-chief of Red Maryland, and you at 410-319-8888. But let me play another clip for us so we can wrestle with something here. One of the interesting parts of the debate last night, besides the flat tax, which we can talk about a little bit after this, is each candidate trying to out-conservative the other. We'll talk about who is the real conservative in this debate. Is the debate over military spending. Mm. And it took a lot of forms last night. From Donald Trump's saying he would support the Russians, we should support the Russians in Syria and beyond. But let's hear this clip of Senator Rubio and Senator Rand on the question of military spending, and then we'll take it from there.
And yes, I do want to rebuild the American military. I know that Rand is a committed isolationist. I'm not. I believe the world is a stronger and a better place when the United States is the strongest military power in the world.
Marco, how is it conservative to add $1 trillion expenditure for the federal government that you're not paying for? How is it conservative to add $1 trillion in military expenditures? You cannot be a conservative if you're going to keep promoting new programs that you're not going to pay for.
I may respond more quickly. Yeah. Very quickly, Senator. We can't even have an economy if we're not safe. There are radical jihadists in the Middle East beheading people and crucifying Christians. A radical Shia cleric in Iran trying to get a nuclear weapon. The Chinese taking over the South China Sea. Yes, I believe the world is a safer... No, I don't believe. I know that the world is a safer and better place when America is the strongest military power in the world.
Marco, I don't think we're any safer. I do not think we are any safer from bankruptcy court. As we go further and further into debt, we become less and less safe. This is the most important thing we're going to talk about tonight. Can you be a conservative and be liberal on military spending? Can you be for unlimited military spending and say, oh, I'm going to make the country safe? No, we need a safe country. But you know, we spend more on our military than the next 10 countries combined. I want a strong national defense, but I don't want us to be bankrupt.
There's much more to this debate, but let me go to our guests here, and you at 410-319-8888. Again, let me start with Stella, if I might, then go around to Brian and Shipp. Stella, your thoughts on this. I mean, I think there was a real divergence here, between them at least, but there's also the question of the Middle East will be, and how to deal with foreign policy in that arena will also, I think, be center in the general election. But your thoughts on what you just heard?
Well, two things. I think one of the questions is, for not only the Republican Party and where they stand on military issues, but for us as a country as a whole, party or non-party, you know, how strong is a strong military and where do you draw that line and how much resources do you put to having a strong military? One thing that I think one can say about Rand Paul, whether you agree with him or not, he's pretty consistent across the board about his definition of conservatism. And I think he made a really good point last night about whether you can call yourself a conservative if you're willing to spend, outrageously on the military while wanting to cut other things. So it's a matter of priorities and where we set those priorities. And I think one of the debates that's really not only going to play out within the Republican candidates as we move forward, but more broadly in a general election, is how strong is a strong enough military, and how strong of a military does it take to deal with the threats in the Middle East and in other places.
And I think that Brian Griffith, as a resident conservative thinker for the day, anyway, this is one of those issues that really divides the conservative world. The question of military spending, how much spending we should spend on the military, the whole foreign policy question.
Yeah, there are so many moving parts to this debate, because the first part you have the people who want a strong military versus the isolationists, as Rand Paul is, and Senator Rubio was very correct in saying that. There's obviously been an isolationist wing of the Republican Party going back to Senator Vandenberg back in the early 1940s before Pearl Harbor. There's always been an isolationist wing in the party. But even for those Republicans who want a strong military, yeah, there is a difference between those who want a strong modern military and those Republicans who, yes, want to spend a lot of money to have the largest military in the world, regardless of its efficiency or its effectiveness. And even the people who want a strong military are divided between those who want to use it freely and those who want to be judicious with it. I mean, even some people who are, like me, I believe in strength through superior firepower, but I was not before the Iraq war when it went down. I mean, there are these kind of divisions throughout the foreign policy and the military policy spectrum when it comes to the Republican Party. There's a very small isolationist wing and right now, and Rand Paul has most of the support on that. But yeah, the candidates differ greatly when it comes to how to spend it, where we're going to spend it, and how we're going to use it. I think there's no question right now.
Brian, I would push back just a little bit and say I don't think Rand Paul is an isolationist. I certainly don't think he's the isolationist that his father was. And so I think he is labeled that given where he stands within the Republican Party and where he stands with those other people on the stage. But I would push back a little bit in calling him an isolationist. He himself has said many times that he is not an isolationist, that he believes in judicious use of military power, and that we should not be involved in every war overseas. But again, I don't think that particularly makes him an isolationist.
Well, he's certainly not nearly as isolationist as his father, and I think that's safe to say. But his record on military issues is one that is certainly not in line with mainstream Republican thought on military spending and the use of foreign and military policy.
But he may be ship in line with the mainstream of American thought, which is not to have increased involvement overseas with our military.
And I think that's increasingly our position as we see the endless entanglements in which we find ourselves here. I was really interested in this whole attempt to define what it is to be a conservative, and I wonder if that argument kind of gets lost when a candidate such as Rubio can sort of make it an issue of how patriotic you are. If you're willing to keep the country safe, then you have to have this strong military and you have to spend money. So the issue of whether you're spending too much money and whether that's inconsistent with being conservative gets lost to that emotional pull, I think.
I would agree with Senator Rubio to the point that, yes, we have, one of the few federal government responsibilities that we do have, that is to defend our national security. And I think it's one of the I will say that conservatives would agree broadly that one of the few federal programs that deserves an appropriate amount of spending is defense. Again, there are arguments as to how much spending is appropriate or not, but that gets into a broader conversation of the conservative view of the role of government and things far beyond the foreign and military policy spectrum. I certainly would agree to a point that if you look at the broader electorate and the appetite for further military intervention, we've seen that appetite for military intervention go down based on President Obama's two elections. But we've also seen general approval, maybe not necessarily in polling and certainly at the ballot box, for the president, President Obama's wide and expansive use of the military during his two terms in office.
And part of that has to I'm going to go to the phones here, but this is a debate for another day. And part of that has to do with, I think this is the most distant the American Republic has been from war in my lifetime.
Distance in terms of?
Well, you know, I mean, there was a draft. Everybody was involved. Mm-hmm. Everybody and their father, a father's father, went and fought in World War II. Everybody in my generation was drafted and had to deal with the Vietnam War in one way or the other, right? I mean, so and the society was debating this because you were hot in the middle of it. We're no longer in the middle of it. We have a few people now doing the fighting. And war is very different in a very different kind of setting. So I think America is like very skittish about this.
And that's what makes it so dangerous, given the dangers we face from terrorism, the dangers we face from Russia, China potentially as well.
So we'll get back into that. But let me go to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Joseph, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, good morning. How are you guys doing?
Very well. Welcome.
Good. So a couple of quick points. You know, the first thing is, how long do you think it would be would take if I were to convince 12 million Americans that not paying their taxes was a good thing to do?
What do you mean by that?
Before the rest of the country would get on board and say, okay, we're all just going to stop paying taxes. I mean, we talk about immigration and in terms of 12 million people being here and what we're going to do with them. But the fact of the matter is that, like it or not, these people have violated our laws. And as a sovereign nation, we have a responsibility and a duty to the citizens of this country to enforce the law. The law needs to be equally applied to everyone. And in doing so and not enforcing the law, we are undermining our own system. There is no respect for government and law when government refuses to enforce the laws equally on everyone. That's the first point.
Okay.
The second point is with regard to Ben Carson, you know, and the notion that he has no experience in government. I remind you guys that the founders of our country had no experience in government, and I think that a big part of the problem in our country right now is the establishment candidates. And I'm not Republican, Democrat. I'm absolutely totally against the two-party system. I think this country can do better. And then one last point, if you would indulge me, please. The notion that Carson is kind of standing for Jim Crow economics and sharecropping and so forth, to me, is crazy. I mean, I think there's definitely some issues there that we need to take into account. But with what specifically relates to black people and the detriment to black people in this country in the last 15 years, more than diabetes, high blood pressure, and black-on-black crime, legalized abortion has killed more blacks than anything.
All right, so let me get back to what we were talking about here. And I appreciate the call, Joseph McConnell. Our next caller is Nick. But let me take this one piece first, and then I'm going to turn to Stella to jump into the immigration question, and we can all debate that here for a moment. But Ben Carson, when he said that the founding fathers had no political experience, is actually wrong. Almost every person who the first presidents, the signers of the Declaration of Independence, had all served in capacity in their state houses of government, had been involved in politics, run political parties, been in the midst of politics of the early part of the revolution in this country. They were not separate from politics. They were actually knee-deep in politics from the very beginning. The House of Burgess in Virginia, in New York, in Pennsylvania.
That's how they happened to be drafted to be part of the Constitutional Convention.
So Ben Carson was completely wrong about that, just about that. So let's just talk about this question of taxes and immigrants. I mean, we just finished looking at my producer here, a 50-state analysis by Taxation Economic Policy Institute that found that undocumented immigrants actually pay $11.8 billion in taxes in this country.
And they pay into benefits they may never see again because of their status. You know, I think the caller taps into a pretty wide sentiment that a lot of people would agree with, and that's the fact that our laws need to be enforced. I think we would be hard-pressed to find a lot of people who don't agree with that. And I think in any sort of debate about comprehensive immigration reform, that's a part of it that people don't have a huge issue with. But we get back to the issue of, you know, and I pose this to the caller and other people that feel the same way as the caller. What do we do with the undocumented immigrants that are already here? Yes, we can talk about enforcing the law and we can talk about passing comprehensive immigration reform that has a huge part of it in terms of enforcement. You know, how that plays out practically has been the problem for many years in terms of federal and state division of labor to enforce immigration policy. And we can certainly get into that, which would be another whole discussion. But the issue is, what is a plan to do something with the 11, 12 million undocumented immigrants that are already here? So we can talk about enforcing the law. That's a separate argument than saying we're going to throw them all out and we're going to put forward something that is going to be very expensive, that is totally impractical, that cannot be done, that nobody has put forward any kind of specificity about how we're going to deal with that.
Yeah, Stella took the words right out of my mouth on that. I mean, it's you know, they're, you know, everybody agrees with the idea that, you know, we need to enforce the law and that we need comprehensive immigration reform. There's no practical plan that I've seen, and nobody's probably going to come up with one to talk about how you're going to deport 12 million people. I want to shift the question real quick. Joseph had mentioned the issue about abortion, and I think you know, abortion has killed 56 million unborn children in this country.
If you believe, if that's where you believe in.
But I think, you know, and it is disproportionately oftentimes affects the African-American and the urban community and the poor. This issue also is going to come up possibly in the presidential election next year, not necessarily in the issue of abortion, but in the issue of assisted suicide, because we've seen the studies. It's happened here. It's happened in Oregon. It's happened in other places where assisted suicide has been legal. Assisted suicide targets predominantly African-Americans and poor and poorer folks in the states where assisted suicide has been legalized. And I think that's going to wind up coming up as an issue in the presidential campaign next year as well.
Maybe. I'm not sure how those – they could. I mean, I don't want to get diverted into the question of women's right to choose and assisted suicide at the moment. I don't want to get taken off to the side there with that. But, Chip.
Well, I was interested in the callers taking issue with comparing Carson's policies with the sharecropping and such. He does have a strange way of seeing the world. He thinks that raising minimum wages means a loss of jobs. And the people who are worse off because of this are black teenagers, who he said are unemployed at a higher percentage, I think 19%, something like that. But he's in favor of a wage system that would pay a different kind of minimum wage to you based on your age, which seems a little ridiculous to me. He also thinks that all you have to do is work very hard and you can ascend the ladder of opportunity. He and Trump both said something like that last night. So whether you reject the term sharecropping or not, it is a weird way of seeing the economic possibilities for black people that he claims to love.
Well, let me say this. You know, the we have CBO studies have shown that if you raise the minimum wage, people lose their job. We've already seen in Seattle where the minimum raise has been waged to $15 an hour. We've already seen not only folks lose their job, we've already seen people in fast food restaurants replaced with machines that can do their job for the price of one worker for a year, for nine workers for a year can do it for one worker. But we've also seen the hidden cost of raising the minimum wage is inflation. When you have higher wages, the cost of all goods goes up. There's no actual economic benefit to increasing the minimum wage.
But economists differ on that point.
Yeah, they do, usually.
They differ significantly on that point.
I mean, that, I think so. That's when you were just saying, I was reading before we came here this study, I mean, that the majority of economists actually don't agree with that point of view, conservative and liberal. There's a real gap, and some, and maybe 40% do. There's a huge gap in that, and many people argued, and I've read another study just the other day when we were talking about Seattle, is that many people say this is the direction that all fast food is moving in, period, which is automation. It has nothing to do with the minimum wage. It has to do with their desire to save money and make more money, and not the minimum wage. I mean, so there's all kinds of arguments can be had one way or the other.
Then it,
there's no
and,
clear.
And, yeah, exactly. That comes to the argument. If automation is coming anyway, why do we want to raise the minimum wage, increase the flow of automation, and then you still have unskilled workers who are not qualified to get other jobs?
There may be a neural connector between automation and the minimum wage, what I'm saying.
It does make automation a lot quicker and gives the businesses a lot more incentive to automate.
I'm not so sure. Well, that's, again, an argument that I think that is a real divide on where the future of the economy is going. But I think that's an important discussion.
High wage earners as well as low wage earners. So the argument for automation has not been shown to have a causation toward the minimum wage, simply a correlation at this point from the studies that I have read.
Let me go to the phones here. Come right back. This is really interesting. We should get you back here when you have another day you can come in and really have that debate. 410-319-8888. Nick, line two, you're on the air. Welcome.
Mark, always, you know, just a great discussion. And, you know, I'd just like to say Ben Carson is, I think, one, you brought up an excellent point about what he said about the founders. I don't call them the founding fathers because I think about 80% of them owned slaves.
Well, not that many, but a lot of them did. Yes, you're correct.
But, the founders absolutely they were political. So, I mean, when you get into this world where you're actually fact-free like Sarah Palin or somebody, is just ludicrous. I think that there's a lot about him that, I mean, vote progressive and maybe even say liberal. If you want to classify me as liberal, somebody that cares about worker rights and human rights, call me what you want to call me, progressive or liberal. So, yeah, I might be, you know, maybe not bent towards Ben Carson, but I have to look at what he's saying, what he's proposing. A lot of what he says is fact-free. And just, I think instead of being hit too hard, I think the media is not is giving this guy a pass or not asking him, okay?
Thank you.
Asking him very hard questions. One more thing, I know you have plenty of calls, but to that panelist you had, I think, see, what's happening is there before the grace of God go I. And I don't know you personally, sir. But if you're working for a $1 billion company like Burger King or McDonald's, and they're trying to pay you as little as possible, you know, hey, take that perspective. Thank you.
All right, so let's have some thoughts here before we have. Are we going to play this clip real fast? Yes, we're going to play this clip. This is a clip on minimum wage, I believe, that we're playing. So let's play this, and we'll have some closing thoughts from our panelists here.
Being hurt by you. Well, first of all, thank you for not asking me what I said in the 10th grade. I appreciate that.
I'll just forget that follow-up
there. I have no problem with being vetted. What I do have a problem with is being lied about and then putting that out there as truth. But, you know, when I look at somebody like Hillary Clinton, who sits there and tells her daughter and a government official that, no, this was a terrorist attack, and then tells everybody else that it was a video. Where I came from, they call that a lie. And
all right, Stella. Stella?
You know, I think with Ben Carson, the interesting thing is that he has made his life story the cornerstone of his political campaign. And it's very difficult to do that and then have that the life story scrutinized and, you know, be outraged about it. I don't necessarily agree with his statement about the fact that he's okay with being vetted but is not okay with being lied about. I'm perfectly happy to stand corrected, but I'm not sure what lies have been put forward. I think what has been put forward is that it's been difficult to corroborate some of the things that he has stated about his life story. Now, if that's the same as lying, then maybe he and I have a different definition about lying. But you know, it's very difficult to walk, you know, both sides of the fence with that. When your life story and what you've done and the events of your life are the cornerstone of your campaign and why people like you, by the way, why he has the support that he has from the base that he has that support, it's very difficult to then turn around and say, you know, now I don't like the scrutiny that is being put to the spotlight that's being put to my life story. And I have no responsibility to respond to that. I think that's a hard line to walk.
It is. We've been in closing thoughts here. I think, are we about, you're running to the end here? Yeah, so Ship and then Brian and Stella.
Well, it'll be interesting to watch what becomes of Carson's campaign now. His opponents are afraid to touch him because of the potential issue of racism being raised here. But I think they really do need to, and I think we might see some of them, you know, becoming a little bolder now that they see that there are some gaps in his story.
And I just say this, that the gap in the story to Brian Griffith is that I interviewed Ben Carson a number of times, and in his book it does say, I got a scholarship to West Point but turned it down, which is exactly what he said.
If I need somebody to operate on my brain, I'll call Ben Carson in a heartbeat. But politics is a sport. Presidential politics is the NFL, and that means not for long if you're not ready for people to come after your record and come after and lie about you. I mean, every level of politics, there have been people in my own party here that have lie about me all the time. You just shake it off, and that's, you know, it is what it is. But the more scrutiny Ben Carson gets, the further his poll numbers will hopefully fade, and I think that we will. I will go on record as saying I predict that neither Trump nor Carson will be our party's nominee.
So
will be.
Yeah, I'll go on record as saying that as well. I don't think either one of them will be the nominee. I think one of the strongest arguments that has come out of this whole vetting of his record is, you know, how he's handled it. A lot of people can probably sweep away the responses and whether they match what he wrote at one point. But the fact that he, you know, he doesn't look presidential in the way that he's responded to the scrutiny. And I think if that continues, if there's more scrutiny and more pressure put on him, that he'll fade even quicker.
I want to thank the three. This has been a great discussion. It's good to have all three of you with us for this time. Stella Rouse, who is director of the Center for American Politics and Citizenship at the University of Maryland College Park. Brian Griffiths, who's editor-in-chief of Red Maryland. E.R. Shipp, who's journalist in residence here at the Global School of Journalism at Morgan State University. Thank the three of you so much for the time you've given our listeners today.
It was great to be back, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you all. And we'll continue this. We have a lot of stuff to cover in the next year up to November, so we'll be gathering these folks back again. We're going to take a very brief break. On our way to break, let me remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. And when we come back from break, we meet a really interesting artist, Evan Kojo, The Last Tribe. Don't go away.